Is it working?
It's working.
David, what are you saying?
What is this?
A little bit louder. A little louder, Ken.
Well, welcome to the Dallas Philosophers Forum. We're a 501c3 nonprofit organization that exists solely for your benefit. And our sole mission is to pursue and discuss philosophical ideals. And I know it's hard to believe that there's an organization that that's all they do, but we seem to make it work here. A couple of announcements just having to do with administrative things. First of all, those of you who joined us for dinner, we're glad you came this evening, but we would like for you to pay for your dinner before you leave. And if you would please not do that here, don't pay the waiter, but please pay after the meeting at the counter, all right? Because what happens is we end up keeping the waiter here while our speaker's trying to make his point, and it's a little disruptive. So if he gives you your check, if you please just hang on to it, and please take the restaurant as you leave. And I'm sure I'm going to remind you of this one more time tonight before we actually walk out. The other thing I'd like to mention is that, of course, you came in. Most of you stopped at the table here where Rob Olson is sitting, and you paid $5, which is our regular meeting fee. Or if you were a student, you pay $2. But we also have the best, almost half-price deal in town, is that for $35, you can attend for 10, I'm sorry, not 10,
12,
6
months.
No, 6
months.
Contiguous months.
Okay.
So that's like 12 meetings. So if you do the math, and that's wrong, we'll let me know. But anyway, $35 for 6 months. All right, one kind of unusual item of business before I introduce our speaker for the evening. We've been meeting, kind of starting dinner around 6 or 6:30, and then our presentation begins at 7:30. And we have to be out of the restaurant by 9 o'clock. And so we have to get the speaker's presentation and our Q&A. And this group really likes the Q&A, and we really like to hang around and discuss things. So your board is contemplating changing the start of the meeting to 7 p.m. So tonight, we would like to get your input on whether or not that would work for you, that's feasible. And that would give us a little more time to get these announcements done, to have the speaker make a presentation, to have a Q&A, and still have some social time. In years past, we might be at a restaurant that had a bar or a bar close by. We kind of tend to migrate to the bar, but that's not the situation here. So what I'm going to ask you, if starting at 7 p.m., would work for you, and it's not going to keep you from attending the Dallas Philosophers Forum. Let's just raise your hand. Okay, Rob's keeping score here, right? I'd say it's a majority.
Yeah, I'd say it's a majority, for sure.
Well, thank you very much. The board is actually going to be meeting this coming week, and so we will let you know about the implementation, the time change. I don't really think it's going to start anytime real soon, but it probably will after a couple of months, or maybe the first of next year. All right, any other announcements that I forgot to make before I introduce our speaker?
Cell phones.
Yes, please quiet anything that makes noise. And I think I left mine in the car, so that's not a problem. Okay, great.
Do you hear music?
Yes. Yeah, let's get that turned on.
Yeah, David's going to go. Thank you, David.
Okay, this evening we're privileged to have Dr. York Rieger.
Rieger.
See, I was actually trying to pronounce his first name. He said, yeah, that's about right. I said, but yeah, but that's Texan. You know, so Rieger.
Thank you.
It's Wendland Cook, Professor of Constructive Theology at the Perkins School of Theology at SMU. Dr. Rieger has a PhD in Theology and Ethics from Duke University. Recently, I attended a workshop in which he was speaking about the topic of one of his books, and I thought it would be of interest to this group. He's written several books, but the book that we were talking about is called No Rising Tide. No Rising Tide. And so I think that in this discussion tonight, and in the book, he sort of developed the concept of the logic of the downturn. You know, we've been through this economic downturn, and we're sort of maybe on an upturn, but nobody's quite sure. It certainly is gradual. But he talks about some opportunities from a religious perspective that have to do with the upturn. I'll let him describe that in his talk. So without further ado, Dr. Rieger.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Appreciate the invitation, and this is really interesting to me also because I hear this is a group that likes to discuss things, so I will only talk for about 30 minutes and then open it up because I think a lot of value really is gained in the discussion. Now, my own pedigree, you know, philosophically, it's all a bit complicated. I'm a systematic theologian. Now, systematic theology was always a place where theology and philosophy met. So philosophy was always one of our discussion partners. In addition to that, though, more recently, we've also embraced questions from the social sciences. And more recently, a part of what I'm doing from cultural studies, which is another sort of breed of academic inquiry that brings together, on the one hand, social scientific questions, on the other hand, maybe the more softer sciences of the humanities. In Germany, of course, we had our own philosophical pedigree, so, you know, German idealism and all that, you know, Kant and Hegel and that's what you're raised with. One thing I never knew in Germany was that there was actually French philosophy. My parents' house is about 400 miles from Paris, in Germany, right? But you go east, you go west, then from my parents' house you hit Paris. But we had never talked about structuralism, post-structuralism, those kinds of things, while in Germany. I picked that up during my time at Duke, and that added another whole set of philosophical issues and questions. However, what I realized after a while, you know, you're teaching theology in a seminary context at a university. A lot of people get very tired with philosophical debates, and so very oftentimes I bring other issues together with the philosophies. And so I'm not always pushing theory very heavily, but the sort of implications. So you talk about epistemology. Well, that sounds really difficult. And in some ways it is, but there are some questions that are not raised in epistemology. So for instance, this is a lectern, right? Now we can talk about all kinds of qualities that this lectern has and whether we can know the thing in itself or not. But one thing we're guaranteed not to talk about as philosophers talking epistemology is how was this lectern produced, right? I mean, what kind of labor went into that? what kinds of trees were cut down, what was the contract of the worker that built this thing, you know, who made the profit off of it. Now, those sound like all political questions or economic questions, perhaps, but I submit to you that those might actually be questions of epistemology as well, and if you really know what this, want to know what this thing is, you have to ask some questions like that. Those are just a few introductory comments. That's not my talk yet, but to raise a few issues that might be explaining to you a little bit where I'm coming from. In this talk, I want to talk about religion and economics. Now, I know some of you are actually economists, and I know Rob's teaching in the business school, and so some people might well know a lot more about economics than I do. Then there's religious studies, some of you have experiences there. But I want to talk about some basic issues here. On the surface of it, very often you find that economics and philosophy, the way they're defined, or economics and religion are defined as on the opposite ends of the spectrum. So you have people thinking about economics as something that can be measured, that's just the facts, you know, that it's a way of assessing reality. Of course, it will eventually affect your pocketbook, so you better do it right. That is one of the approaches to economics, where economists very oftentimes perceive themselves as scientists. They study numbers, data. My wife, Rosemarie, who came along, is a molecular biologist, and so I know what it's like to be living in close proximity with a scientist. And of course, that's one thing. And religion is oftentimes defined as exactly the opposite of that, right? You have numbers, data on the one hand, you have big ideas, concepts on the other hand. And so the question is, how would these two areas ever be talking to each other? How would they ever have anything to say to each other? The interesting thing is, there's now a group of economists who are talking about economics as religion. There's a book by that title, economist Robert Nelson wrote it a few years ago, Economics as Religion. And what these economists are saying is that there is a division of labor in the field where the top economists, people like Nelson, who I think worked for the State Department for some time, and others say the top economists are no longer the ones who are crunching the numbers. They're not the analysts. They're not the ones who actually look at empirical evidence. Their job is to keep the big ideas before people. They're the ones that make sure, you know, we follow the principles that argue, you know, the logic of the big ideas, and that makes sure then that people keep, the way they put it, the faith. So these economists actually compare economics to religion, and they say, I mean, this is not me talking, this is economists themselves saying, economists, now the top economists, are like the high priests of economics. Of course, now that feels like finally we have something to talk about, because, you know, then you have religionists, philosophers on the other side that also do that, you know, they have the big ideas, and they check on the big ideas. But I'm wondering if this is really a very helpful approach, whether in economics or in religion. Now, this might come as a surprise, because I'm not really accepting the definition of religion as basically dealing with big ideas, faith claims, and so on. But I'll get to that in just a moment. In fact, I'm raising the question whether part of our problem today is precisely this approach that looks at economics as religion, in terms of keeping the big ideas before us, because I submit to you that these big ideas are actually not really helping us. What do I mean by that? President Kennedy, years ago, many years ago now, in a speech in Arkansas at the building of a dam, used this phrase, you know, a rising tide will lift all boats. And that became, in some ways, an economic principle. While it may not be actually formulated exactly that way, the idea is if the wealthy are doing better, everybody's doing better. And this is, of course, a widely accepted economic principle today that then leads to policy decisions that have to do with tax cuts for the wealthy, that have to do with subsidies for corporations and so on. Of course, not just individual wealthy tax cuts, but really tax cuts for corporations. This is the sort of thing that we're talking about. Now, the question is this really happening or is it not happening? Is this wishful thinking? Some people in the unions have said this is actually happening. The rising tide is lifting all boats. But we also have to discuss what happens to people who are not in a boat. Because if the tide rises and lifts all boats, if you're not in a boat, you might be in trouble. So, the basic philosophical principle here is questioned, not in terms of let's discuss the logic of it, but let's actually analyze what's happening to people. Now, one thing we know, that the gap between the rich and the poor is now greater than ever in the history of the United States. It's actually a few times greater than it ever was in the Roman Empire. So it's not like this is something that's insignificant, but here is a piece of evidence, actual study of the material, empirical evidence, that seems to say something else. Or, a title like this, No Rising Tide, might imply now, of course, that this rising tide stuff is all over. I'm not saying that at all. In fact, I realize that the economy continues to go in cycles. I mean, the cycles are changing somewhat. But we had the Great Recession, and the markets are recovering to some degree, although some people are saying they're also going down again very soon. But the problem here is with the no rising tide, and again, there is empirical evidence for that, that fewer and fewer people are benefiting from the rising tides. So while the economy continues to go in cycles, and from a macroeconomic perspective, you can argue that fewer people are actually now benefiting from it than ever. So again, here is an argument that might actually have to be taken into account by those who promote the big numbers and statistics. Then, of course, you have the Bipartisan Congressional Research Office, which in September 2010 did a study basically concluding that cutting taxes to the wealthy has not helped produce jobs or stimulate the economy for the decades in which this was done. So here you have a bunch of empirical evidence that might be quite helpful to be introduced into that discussion of the great ideas. Now, this is just a snapshot, really a caricature of economics. Let's look at religion on the other hand. Very often we assume that religion basically is the same thing, keeping the big ideas before people. And then you have a pastor, or even better, a systematic theologian building those systems. By the way, it's a long and interesting argument why my title now is Professor of Constructive Theology, because some of us do not believe in systematic theology anymore. So there are some real reasons, and those are, of course, not just my personal decisions, but these are some of the big movements in the field. That are quite interesting. But so here the idea that religion is basically about belief, and then belief meaning believing in something without evidence, that's of course one model, but it's a narrow one. And I submit to you it's really a modern understanding, perhaps even misunderstanding of religion, that is harmful to religion itself, and I really getting ready to argue here, it's creating some havoc in economics as well, this attitude. Because I'm wondering, very practically speaking here for a second, whether this tendency to accept things on face value, not to question, not to think critically, but simply arguing your big ideas, whether this tendency is actually doing us in, both in religion and economics, And perhaps this is a tendency that is nurtured in a certain religious environment, and then of course gets transferred onto other fields like economics. What am I saying here? I'm saying that religion could be something else too. Let me give you one example. In the Gospel of Matthew, there's a situation when John the Baptist has been thrown into prison. Now, he was a radical guy, remember, and so he has been locked up by the powers that be, and he sends his disciples to Jesus, asking the following question: are you the one who is supposed to come, or should we wait for someone else? And Jesus' answer is really interesting, because he doesn't say what most people would expect him to say. What Jesus does not say is, don't lose faith, John. Just believe. One day we'll all be in heaven together. Jesus doesn't say that. Or Jesus doesn't say, no, I have a program, and one day we will have it all in a full-blown form. Right now we don't. Or Jesus could have said, you know, you're a heretic. Doubting me? They put you in prison. So in that sense, you know, thinking of religion as believing in something, John clearly lost his faith in Jesus. But what's Jesus saying in response? I'll read you two verses. This is the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 11, verses 4 and 5. Go and tell John what you hear and see. Right? Empiricism. Go and tell John what you hear and see. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the poor have good news brought to them. Now, if this sounds like a healthcare plan, it's not my fault. But go and tell John what you hear and see. There's stuff happening, and that is what we're talking about when we're talking religion here. Not great beliefs and faith and believing incredible stuff, but look, this is what's going on. I tend to think this is actually almost like a ladder, a scale here that you ascend, you know. How does it start? Blind receive their sight, the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, deaf hear. Then it gets a little more difficult. The dead are raised. That's probably more difficult than the lame walking again. The last one, I think, is the most difficult. And the poor have good news brought to them. Because now that is the thing that nobody believes. Right? I mean, you can see a few people being healed in a TV worship service, you know, walking off without their crutches. But that the poor have good news brought to them, that's hard to believe. That's the thing we think is impossible. And mind you, good news to the poor is not telling them some nice stories or giving them hope for down the road in 20 years or after they die. I mean, good news to the poor really can mean only one thing. They're no longer poor. That's good news to the poor. So, go tell John what you hear and see. What I'm saying here in terms of the definition of religion, sorry, he wasn't in the car. That's all right. Maybe this is a call from Jesus right now. But what we're saying here about religion is, what if religion were not about great ideas, but about making a difference in the world, precisely in those places where we have lost faith, where we cannot imagine this sort of thing going on? So take this to the book of Acts. In the book of Acts, this is again New Testament, the Christians are oftentimes, several times, called the people of the way. So Christianity is not the people of the crazy beliefs, but it is the people of the way, people who practice a certain lifestyle. And that really matches what religion looks like in the ancient world, because religion there is not simply about faith. Beliefs. It's always about practice. It's not something that you can separate between public and private. That's a modern invention. It's not something that you can depoliticize or that has no economic consequences. In the ancient world, those things are always going together. Now, that really gives you a lot of pause for thought, because it basically changes everything. A couple of years ago, I wrote a book, Christ and Empire. And it starts with a chapter on the Apostle Paul. And what I realized, just reading some of the findings of New Testament scholars, is that Paul thinks about religion in this more complex way. So when Paul talks about the sort of stuff that we think is just great ideas, he actually talks about something else. So Paul talks about Jesus Christ as Lord. You all know that, right? Lord is such a great phrase that's always used in evangelical circles. But what he's really saying is Jesus Christ is Lord in a place where somebody else bears that title. Everybody knows that Caesar is Lord. And so if you say Jesus is Lord, you're creating a real conflict. Now, that could be resolved in modern times by saying, well, Jesus is Lord over your religious life, what you do Sunday mornings, and Caesar is Lord over everything else. It just doesn't work that way in the ancient world, though. And this is, the Romans realized that. That's why they didn't like the Christians very much, because that was dangerous. The Romans had no problem with religion. They were religiously tolerant, religion here in a broad sense. You know, they would integrate Isis and Osiris and the old Greek gods in their pantheon. That worked. They couldn't integrate the Christian God because that one didn't fit. And not just because it was a different idea. It was a whole different way of life. And if you look at Paul, you know, you could go on like that. When Paul talks about faith, pistis, you know, in Greek, or fides, what he was basically saying was not it's about believing all kinds of incredible stuff. But when Paul talks about faith, the Roman subjects were supposed to have faith in the Roman emperor. What did that mean? It wasn't about believing all kinds of crazy stuff. Oh, they believed that the emperor was divine. Big whoop. But what was really important here was, I pledge allegiance to ... That's what faith means. So for the Roman subjects, faith in the emperor meant, of course, you believe all kinds of things, but most importantly, I pledge allegiance to the Roman emperor. So when the Christians then pledged faith in Jesus Christ, that's what they were doing. Not just believing crazy things about Jesus Christ, but I pledge allegiance to Jesus Christ in conflict with allegiance to the emperor. Now, usually when I'm at that point, somebody says, maybe Jesus looked at this differently, because there's this well-known story where they ask him if they should pay taxes to the Roman emperor. And you know his response, right? He says, well, show me the money. So he looks at the coin and says, well, whose image is on the coin? Well, it is the image of the Roman emperor. And then the famous conclusion, so give Caesar, or the emperor, what is the emperor's, and give God what is God's. In terms of our modern distinction between, you know, religion and politics, you could say, well, that's an easy solution. God gets religion, and the emperor everything else. Right? This is great. This is why they like religionists. You know, we have such a small territory in church Sunday mornings, you know, Sunday school classes, you name it. But maybe there is a little bit more at stake. And remember, you know, the people, when they hear it, are really flabbergasted. What's this guy talking about? Because for an ancient Jew, it was quite clear. What belongs to God? Well, if you come out and say, religion, says, okay, keep on going. What else belongs to God? Church buildings? Okay, keep on going. What else belongs to God? You know, religious, professional. Well, move on now. Remember the beginning of Genesis in the Bible? In the beginning, God created the church, some Christians, some religious people. Right. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. That was the insight. You know, what belongs to God? If God's God, if that makes any sense at all, it's got to be everything. So here you're creating a bit of a conflict. So what I'm saying now about religion is that it's not necessarily understood as just the big ideas or beliefs in something that's otherwise absurd. And now you have a conflict. Now you have religion actually talking about what's happening in real life just as much as economics is. So they function really now on these various planes. You can no longer separate it in terms of one's the science of reality, the other one's the science of ideas or something like that. And I think that would apply down the road for philosophy as well. Now, let me conclude with a couple of challenges here, because I think those are some really important questions to be raised on the basis of this. If you accept that there is something to that, now, of course, the question becomes, how exactly do we see religion at work in this world? And there are at least two options. There are more, but really for the sake of clarifying my argument. The first one that we see all the time when people understand that religion is not just ideas, the first one is to assume that God is on the side, and squarely on the side of the status quo. This is what happened to religion eventually, you know, after Paul. There were some forces that realized that this could be too dangerous, and so after a while, and then of course with Constantine in the 4th century, you had religion become part of the empire itself. Joining forces, saying, well, this is where we see God. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, then meant God created the things like they are now, including the Roman Empire. And of course, the Roman Empire is here to last because this is what God wanted. Now, years later, we realize that it didn't last. But they saw the same thing, and you know, the German, das Heilige Römische Reich, Deutsche Nation, that's the German expression, that was our understanding with Charlemagne, you know, that the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation. That didn't last either. Then you had the British Empire, that didn't last either. Then you had the U.S. being founded, you know. And then you had capitalism. Now, for sure, that's going to last. But I mean, you see the basic assumptions. Why is it going to last? Because this is the expression of God in our time. And, you know, I mean, I don't want to make fun of anybody who believes that. I mean, I think this is a deeply held belief. Unfortunately, it's often held unconsciously. When I ask my students what they think is more likely, the world's going to go up in flames or capitalism's going to end, guess what they're saying? The world's going up in flames. The one question and the other question is if capitalism is ever going to end. They can see the world going up in flames tomorrow. They cannot in any way see capitalism ever to end. Now, that would be, well, maybe capitalism is such a great system, but maybe it's also theologically here endorsed by who we think God is and what God is doing. Now, there's another alternative, and this is the one that interests me, that I have been working on a lot in my own work, and that I've gotten some flack for. I'm sure we get some heated discussions on this one. Because it seems to me there's another strand in these ancient Jewish Christian traditions that says the opposite, that talks about how God is at work on the side of the least of these. In the beginning of the Gospel of Luke, there is Mary's song of praise, the Magnificat, right? You'll remember it, where Mary talks about the lowliness of God's servant and how she's glad that God lifted up this low servant. That's the part we usually remember, you know, humble Mary, so grateful that God paid attention to her. But then Mary continues and has some things to say, like, God who lifts up the lowly is also the one who pushes the powerful from their thrones. Then Mary goes on to talk about God having filled the hungry. By the way, this has an almost direct parallel in the Old Testament. Hannah, the mother of Samuel, prays a similar prayer in the book of Samuel. So here, then God fills the hungry with good things. boy, you know, I mean, religion can get mileage out of this till the cows come home, because this is such a beautiful passage, such a beautiful idea, except that it's followed immediately by this notion that God, who fills the hungry with good things, also sent the rich away empty. Now, if I were to say this here in Dallas, and by the way, this is my 19th year at SMU Perkins, so I've been around for a while, people would not like this. They would probably hope it's against me. But here, I mean, this is Mary, the mother of Jesus, talking. Luke chapter 1, I'm just footnoting somebody else here. Now, I quoted this in a recent piece of writing. The editor sent it back and said, that's really beautiful, but it seems so unrealistic. Now, is this just a dream, or what difference is any of this making? You know, you're just raising people's hopes, and this is false. It hasn't borne out. That was wishful thinking on the side of Mary. So what do you say? Well, here, you need another empirical argument. Simply the argument of faith is,
well, no, I believe in a God who is different, and I really hope that this God one day, maybe tomorrow or next week, will come through. Nice, you know, I mean, you could debate that for a long time. My response to it was different. And I'll give you a response here in closing that comes straight out of American history. If you think about the sort of things that we are proud of in this country, our Constitution, our democracy, Bill of Rights, where is that stuff coming from? Of course, some of it is coming from the great ideas. You have Europe, you have the Enlightenment. That's clear. I mean, that's, I think we would all agree on that. But some other stuff is not coming from there. Voting rights. Okay. Now, we have a democracy, we have voting rights, but who gets to vote? You know the history, right? The founding fathers didn't think of giving anyone else a right to vote but the white males with property. So, but now women have a right to vote, black people have a right to vote. Where is that coming from? God, who lifts up the lowly, pushes the powerful from their thrones. And some people are dead scared that women and black people and Hispanics and all these folks have a right to vote. It's dangerous. But where is it coming from? It's not coming from one great person or another who once said, you know, we really want women to vote too. No, I mean, women had to fight this fight. How did they fight it? Well, all kinds of things. Organizing, you know, picketing on the streets. But religion was part of that. Same thing for the race issue. You know, how was abolition defeated? All kinds of strategies. But religion was an important part of that. There was a slave owner's theology. There was a slave theology. That to the slave owners, of course, never sounded like much. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. Let him sing that. But the slaves were not singing about a coach that comes to take him to heaven. They were thinking about the Underground Railroad. They were thinking about the chariot that comes to actually liberate them. And guess what? That happened. Or, you know, this discussion, can we meet here at 7 o'clock? Well, that sounds like an easy sort of thing, but if you're able to meet here at 7 o'clock, maybe you're retired. And if not, you might have to thank a unionized worker for that. Because otherwise you'd be working 14, 16, 17 hours a day without the 8-hour work day. Or without a weekend off. Or without a benefits plan, a health care plan, those kinds of things. Where's that coming from? Well, never at a point in history was there just happy thinking, you know, that we have to give all this to the workers. So, no, the workers stood up and they got it for themselves. Again, that wasn't just, you know, a class struggle. That was religion being with them. There were lots and strong religion and labor movements. 100 years ago, they had camp meetings in this part of the world, North Texas, Southeastern Oklahoma, 10,000 people gathering in one place. Well, you know all that. But what you don't know, I bet you, is that some of these 10,000 people, camp meetings, were camp meetings of Christian socialists. In Texas, northeastern Oklahoma, southeastern Oklahoma, I mean, northeastern Texas. Maybe that was just wishful thinking, but it seems like some things happened out of that. And the weird thing is not that it happened, but that we don't remember any of it. This is not part of our narrative. So this editor could say, well, here you have your wishful thinking based on Mary, the mother of Jesus. That's just worth nothing. Well, in reality, even in our own history, I mean, I could go on and give you examples here. There is something here that is actually pointing in this direction, how a lot of this change comes from the bottom up. There's new work done on the historical Jesus. Richard Horsley wrote a book, Jesus and Empire, and what Horsley argues, among many other things, is that there was a reason why the Romans wanted to get rid of Jesus. The reason for that was not just because he was a radical preacher. Because, as Horsley finds, there were other radical preachers in the first century. There was actually another guy, Jesus ben Hananiah, Jesus the son of Hananiah, who was also a radical preacher at the time of Jesus of Nazareth. And the Romans caught him, beat him up, and let him go. In the case of Jesus of Nazareth, as you know, radical preacher too, the Romans captured him with the help of the Jewish elites, and they didn't let him go, they killed him. Horsley says the difference between those two was they were both having radical sermons, but one of them was an organizer and the other one wasn't. The other one was just a great teacher. The other one was actually, forming disciples, forming communities, which later on, of course, as you all know, became the church. So this is part of that story of religion as moving from the other way around that I think is something that is very interesting in these old Jewish and Christian traditions. We haven't even talked about the Jewish tradition, but I could tell you a lot more about that. Not now, though. But now you get this. Of course, we think this is all Jesus. Paul's radical here. Old Testament too, who was the first labor leader in the Old Testament? A man by the name of Moses. God talked to him about a burning bush, right? What's God saying? I have seen the plight of my people. Empiricism. I'm paying attention here. And we're going to liberate them from the oppression of Egypt. Another story here, but that's just a little glimpse. So, if this is the case, and if these religious traditions talk about a move from the bottom up, another sort of being human, another sort of living their life, that's actually powerful, that's not just idealism, maybe we should pay attention to it. Now, you take that back into any other field, you now might ask the question, keeping in mind the separation of church and state, obviously, but how would this translate into politics? How would this translate into economics? What difference would this make in any other area? And I think that would be a very interesting debate to be had. So I'll stop here. I'm sure you have many questions. So far, nobody has kicked me out, so thanks.
Thank you very much. All right, let me just lay out a couple of ground rules before we entertain questions. We would appreciate you keeping your extemporaneous comments to a minimum and actually getting to the point with your question as quickly as possible, and that way more of us will be able to actually ask the question, and I'm going to hand the mic to you so you can be heard by the rest of the group, and then Dr. Reeder will answer your question. So, all right, so Greg's got the first question.
Would you Would you contrast the idea of cruelty before Jesus? That is, they used to tie people to the part of the chariots and make a spectacle of cruelty to them. Now, I submit that in the biggest thing we have of cruelty today is the Nazis. And even the Nazis did not do that cruelty openly. They did it hidden to a certain amount. Now, they didn't make a real big effort to hide it, but they hid it, even though this was an unpopular group of people. Now, I submit that there was a change in human psyche and human the spirit that went with Christ at that time. But would you like to comment on that difference, if you see that difference?
I mean, I think you have a point that there is a difference. In some ways, it shapes up differently, but it kind of pendulum swings back and forth, because if you think about times after Jesus where Christians might have been cruel, you come at some really interesting descriptions. You know, the Crusades, the first day the Crusaders arrived in Jerusalem, apparently in a day they killed 30,000 people. Now, that's hard work, especially if you don't have missiles and stuff. I mean, you really have to kill 30,000 people. And the way the contemporaries describe it, the blood flowed down the streets. Or if you think about, you know, the institution Pope Benedict now was heading for a while. I mean, not only as Pope, but before as the prefect for the Congregation of the Faith, the old Inquisition, that was exactly part of what the Inquisition did to people in the Americas. In Europe, I went to kindergarten in Germany next to a building that we called the Hexenturm, that was the witch's tower, in the city wall right next to my kindergarten. And as kids, we always wondered what that was. Well, turns out that the church was keeping people there who were suspected of witchcraft. So, I mean, could give you many more examples. Those are all examples of great cruelty. Fascism, Nazi Germany, I mean, that's part of my own history as a German. Maybe it was more hidden, I think you're right on that one, but on the other hand, it was effective enough that people knew what would actually happen to you if you did not comply. And I remember my grandparents talking about that. So the fact that this is changing, I think, is not universal for everybody, but I think it takes a different approach, a different way of life. And so religion here is not just... See, the problem here we're having with, say, Christianity is not there's one thing called Christianity, but there are many different forms of it. And the dominant forms of these religions are sometimes still quite cruel, while there are alternative forms that completely that live a completely different way of life, and that's of course also real, but that doesn't happen because of just one event. That happens because people very consciously wanted to embrace Jesus and follow Jesus in specific ways of life.
Let's let somebody else ask a question. This gentleman right here.
Really enjoyed your talk. It sounds to me like you're touching on the economic doctrines that rise out of the Torah to some extent, in terms of the attitude towards the poor and the rich, for that matter, and also the prophetic impulse of the prophets, and in terms of the real biblical view of economics that was so fundamental and basic and almost non-spiritual, I mean, to the extent that it was about real problems and solutions that the Torah, the five books of provided.
So you have a question?
Yeah, what I'm asking him is that, matter of fact, the question is given am I understanding you right?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. All right. So that's
let me respond to that, though, because this is a very important comment here. A lot of this, you know, Jesus' response to John the Baptist, or Jesus' first sermon in Nazareth, according to Luke 4, is really Jesus quoting Scripture. So not Jesus making up stuff, but really tying back into the prophetic traditions, prophet Isaiah, for instance.
Right.
So Jesus himself links his own ministry to these very material traditions that you described as not being very spiritual. Well, here's the next thing. Maybe what we call spiritual is really a modern misunderstanding of religion, too, because it distinguishes between spirituality as up here, material reality as down there. For Jesus, I would submit to anyone who wonders, that wasn't a distinction. And for Paul, here's the other thing. You know, Paul, of course, talks about the works of the flesh, the works of the spirit. That sounds very much like here is material, here is spiritual. But when Paul talks about this, he talks about, I mean, Galatians, where is it, 5, the fruits of the Spirit. He talks about it as ways of life. I mean, read what Paul says about the fruits of the Spirit. It's not just one spiritual hovering in space, one's material grounded on the earth, but those are two different ways of life. So spirituality, even for Paul, is ultimately a way of life rather than just a good idea or playing off spirit and matter. The Gospel of John, finally, you know, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. Boy, that always sounded like this was not the sort of spirituality that leaves the Torah. You know, just hovering, free-floating, and John has lots of stuff like that. But then in verse 14, John says, "And the Word became flesh." That brings those two things back together again, and I think that's part of the heritage that a certain spiritualized Christianity has lost. So there, rather than playing the two off against each other, the question out of this heritage becomes, how are they related, and what difference does one make to the other?
So are you saying that, you know, again, applying it to the here and now right now, it sounds to me, if I'm hearing you right, that you're saying that the Torah and the prophetic spirit, prophetic spirit has something that can inform us today as to practical ways upon which we could solve economic problems.
It has some input, yes. I mean, I would warn, though, and this is something I haven't said yet, I would warn, though, simply applying these principles to today as if there were not a difference in time and location. So I'm not at all now arguing that we should simply emphasize something that you find in the Bible and say we need to do that. That still needs a lot of perfection, but in principle, I think, what I'm arguing for is that we have some debates about that. And I'm really arguing, of course, I give you my position here. I'm really arguing also for a broad debate, you know. So this is not liberals versus conservatives. This is now liberals and conservatives talking together about how do you understand the Jubilee year. Now, we were taught about the Jubilee year, right? Seven times 7 years. And then you release your slaves. You return the land to its original owners. You forgive all the debt. What they taught us in seminary, hey, that was a nice idea, it never happened. But who can really say that? I mean, these historical records are not easy to come by. And so basically to say, well, that's just a nice idea, degrades these things again to religious ideas, which I think is a mistake, because then we never get to that debate.
There was a question right here.
And I promise to be a little shorter in my responses so we can have a few
more questions. Thank you. You made a reference to a book, Economics as Religion. You talked about religion as faith systems, as a system of beliefs. So that's from that I have these questions. Is under this kind of description, would not Marxism be a religion? Would not religion also be capable of existing without God? And as religion then, under this kind of perspective, another word for faith system?
That's a good question. I appreciate that. The one thing about Marxism that we hate to talk about these days is that when Marx actually puts things together, he's not sitting down dreaming. He's observing economic processes. He's looking at what happens to workers. Now, not saying that anybody has to agree with it necessarily, but you can't see it simply as a belief system. I mean, I'm talking about Marx's own work specifically. You know, some of it later on could become that. I'm not denying that, but that's not the basic argument. In fact, you know, Marx picks up a German idealist argument with Hegel, you know, that the idea that the spirit basically shapes the world. Marx said, well, what if material reality shapes the world? And then you start paying attention. But what's interesting here is that it's a dialectic. So it's not just one or the other. This is what Americans have a hard time understanding. We think materialism is matter shapes everything. Determinism, like neuroscience, your emotions are just chemical processes in the brain. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about how do these things reshape each other. But then we have to say, it becomes dangerous, to stay with your example, it becomes dangerous at the moment when it becomes a faith system, a belief system, without looking specifically at this analysis, what's happening. And here we're saying, what's happening at the grassroots? Economics today, same thing. Let's not just ask what's happening at Wall Street, but what's happening to the homeless guy standing at the corner. That would be part of the study. Can it do without God? Well, sure. Especially if you think about God as a great idea that you then have to prove. Now, I can prove you any kinds of gods that you want, but you'll always find the gods of the system. You know, when the sort of liberal, talking about, shouldn't name names, but some of my predecessors at Perkins assumed they basically had it figured out. God now gets proven through universal human experience. Then human experience crumbles. So at that point, I'm a theologian, somebody who actually believes in God. Don't forget that. I'm not an atheist at all. But the early Christians were called atheists because they believed in something that wasn't like Zeus or Jupiter or any of the other gods. In that sense, I'm atheist too because I don't believe in sort of these big constructs. As a Christian, I'm a Christian, practicing Christian. What I'm looking for is, where is the grass growing through the concrete, as it were? You know, where is the differences happening that we would least expect? Where is the sort of stuff happening that nobody believes could ever happen? That the slaves would ever be free? That the Roman Empire would ever end it? That the concentration camps ever get closed down? That's where I would start asking the God question, but that is not the big question of whatever controls the universe, but what difference God makes in a situation that seems hopeless.
Okay. Over here. Thank you. Following up on questions that were here, over the last decades, I see the prophetic role of religion not very effective. Would you suggest any relevant voices today in politics and economics who are bringing up the most genuine prophetic type of voices?
I have to affirm your observation. It looks like this prophetic spirit that we have had in our own U.S. history is not very strong right now. On the other hand, I think what's different, and actually, my most recent book, now this will raise some eyebrows, is Occupy Religion, Theology of the Multitude. Because what I'm not doing is, I'm not sanctifying the Occupy movement or anything, but I'm precisely asking this question. Are there movements in this history that introduce the prophetic in a different way? Now, with the Occupy movement, it's different from Martin Luther King or Malcolm X, because you don't have any centralized leaders. And you don't have a short list of demands, there are five things we want to change. And so, to a lot of people, that looks ineffective and almost ridiculous. But on the other hand, this could be, again, something that has to be argued, but I'm saying it could be perhaps a way of this prophetic spirit rising in a new generation that's now non-hierarchical, almost said non-teleological, but it has some goals that are not that clear. For me, the interesting question is not so much, what does Obama believe or any other president. Their faith usually gets used for all kinds of purposes, and not always for the most noble ones. But that's pretty general. You know, it's not Republican versus Democrat here. On the other hand, when you see faith bubbling up in these things, I think you should pay attention. I'm paying attention to that. Very specific example here. Raising more eyebrows did. What I see emerging is a new sort of energy that has to do with religion and labor. There's Interfaith Work of Justice, an outfit in Chicago. There's something happening in California. In Dallas, there's Jobs with Justice, which is not a religious organization, but which is doing some good work. I brought my wife as a witness because she's been working with Job with Justice for a while, and paying attention to that, without now raising this to the level of God. So not even my wife is God. I say this here very clearly and openly. That's where I see some hope, or at least something happening that's different from what we've seen.
Hey, Professor.
Yeah.
Before coming tonight, my wife asked me what the subject was, and I said the relationship of religion and economics, and she said, does that have to do with tithing?
Good question.
I said, no, I don't think so. And a couple of questions or things came to my mind. During the Middle Ages, during the feudal times, one of the most heinous crimes that a Christian could commit was usury.
Yes.
Lending money at interest. And so if the Christian couldn't do it, the Jews could. And so the kings, borrowed their money from the Jews. Mm-hmm. But why was it such a heinous crime? Because this was an economy that was not based on money. And so lending money at interest would undermine the whole economy, the whole feudal economy. So it was so religiously bad, banned, and it was a sin, you'd go to hell for it, etc. As we got away from the religious thing, into the modern times, became more secular, more capitalist, we say, as an individual, I'm the master of my fate, I'm captain of my soul, I don't need...
I know there's a question coming.
Okay, I'm getting to the question. And then further on with Marxism, as this man said, we completely did away with religion whatsoever, and did raise the poor. We raised the poor up, to the proletariat, with a dictatorship. So are you saying that there's still a place for religion in economics? It seems to me that we're going to getting rid of religion and economics.
There are several questions I'd love to talk about, but let me start with the last one. There's a lot of wisdom in the American Constitution when there's a separation of church and state. I think that doesn't mean that religion and politics don't have to say anything to each other, but there is a limit. What we don't have, what we might actually need, is a separation of religion and economics, because this is too easily translated into each other, So you have a sort of capitalist mentality that now shapes religion to the core in such a degree that there's a book out there, best-selling book by the title Jesus CEO. Far from separating those two, religion gets co-opted, as we're basically assuming that this is what we all mean. I say this to say this is the place of the religious engagement, not so much religion now making prescriptions, but religion helping us uncover some of our semi-religious or pseudo-religious presuppositions in this. And so when you think about it that way, then you can engage in a critical dialogue. It may well be that it goes that direction, but I wouldn't take that for granted, Jesus CEO. Or the other thing about capitalism, since you mentioned the medieval example, this is another problem I see, say, with progressive discourse in this country. is that capitalism now is simply rejected, this is all bad, it's all morally wrong, it's all terrible. Now, I grew up with my great-grandmother in Germany, who really spent most of her life in what you would consider a feudal world, feudalist system, you know, maybe working as a maid on a large farm. I wouldn't want to change with her. In Marx's point about capitalism was not moralizing, oh, this is all horrible and bad and you shouldn't do it. But it's just to say, you know, this is running its course like feudalism, and there may be alternatives that are developing. Not, we have to do it all, but the system is collapsing. In all these cases, I think religion is learning something, you know. Right now, you know, I have a mortgage. And while I know collecting interest was once forbidden to Christians, I'm not calling my mortgage broker and saying, you're a damn heretic. I pay my mortgage, and there's good reason for doing that. I'm not protesting that at all. But that is to say also, that may not be the last stage. I think Francis Fukuyama was wrong to say this is the end of history. And I'm not exactly telling you what it's going to look like, but to say that this is the way it's always going to be is making some of these same mistakes. So. But thanks for your question.
Okay, you got a gentleman right here. Yeah. There's two different types of wisdom, individual wisdom and social wisdom. And my understanding of the Bible and the Christian faith is it guides us in both. So I think the Christian faith should guide economics, which is a social science. The social wisdom found in Christianity should guide economics, which is a social science, because the truths of religion are compatible with the truths of science and philosophy. Much like in natural theology, science, the truths of science, help us better understand God. Why can't we flip it and use the social wisdom found in Christian theology to guide economics? And I think you can find this prophetic spirit in economic science today if you read the macroeconomics of Joseph Stiglitz. And he, you know, if you look to him, he's got a proven track record. He was the chief economist for Bill Clinton, the last time that we had a balanced budget and a growing economy. So I don't think the Christian faith and economics should be separated. I think they should be integrated.
I think that's in a way what I'm saying too, but what I'm not saying is you use the word guiding, because then I think at that point you have this assumption that there is a sort of a principle that's outside of it that can easily be applied to it. What I would say is put these things in conversation and account for the fact that there are different accounts of the Christian message. You know, there I gave you my account here. I'm sure not everybody agrees with it. But let's argue that. Let's talk about what that actually looks like. And so at that point, what I'm asking for is simply, let's not jump to conclusions too quickly as if these things are always set in stone. But once you enter into the conversation, I think the guiding happens in that rather than me now, you know, as a theologian telling the business world or the market exactly what to do. I wouldn't necessarily want to promote that.
Okay, there was a hand or two back here. There's an economic principle called the 80-20 rule. It says that you put like 100 people together in a room or an island or something like that, over some period of time, 20% of those people are going to wind up with 80% of the wealth or whatever, or the power, influence in the group. And, I think that can probably be applied to religion. It can definitely be applied to economics, finances, military power. Any comments on that? I mean, to me, it seems like
Part of that may involve being more smarter, being more ruthless, maybe being a better salesman, like a rising tide for all boats. That's a good sales pitch to sell your point of view. It may or may not be true, but anyway. Comments?
Boy, lots of comments, actually, but I know, just
we're gonna answer how much, we're gonna have two more questions,
but I really want to address this one. No, the U.S. is proof that the 80-20 principle is false. Why? Well, because if it were 20 people holding, 20% of the people holding the wealth, basically doing well, well, that would be a start. That's not the way it is now. I mean, it's 0.1%. Occupy is not right. It's not 1%, but it's 0.1%. Now, whatever that's worth, I think that is another question that needs to be argued. You could also say that the Jubilee year was designed to address the 80-20% problem, because if that's in fact the case, and I'm not doubting that there is something to that, but then you have to make sure that these scissors, you know, in Europe we always talk about the scissors that go apart, the Scheren, die auseinanderlaufen, then you have to make sure it doesn't go apart forever, because then it just leads to catastrophe. Now, what to do about that? The thing I'm raising, actually, in this No Rising Tide book, this is another part of the debate that we haven't even touched. When we talk about, I mean, Marxism came up, you know, or anything else, or socialism is the big spectrum now, we usually think of distribution and then redistribution, spreading wealth around, that sort of thing. I say that's part of the discussion, but let's talk about production. Let's talk about how wealth and all that is produced, because the American idea that those who have a lot got it because they worked so hard also has to be reevaluated, because there are some people in these 80% that work three times as hard, literally that have three jobs, that do a lot, that are simply not getting ahead. So production here is something that has to figure into the equation. What difference does it make that an auto worker builds a car, while a CEO can CEO all day and not build a car? For instance, you know, I'm not saying that one is worth more than the other, but we now have a system where these scissors are going apart so much. So here, it's not even sharing, distributing, or anything. It's simply the question, how do we value the actual contributions that people are making? And now you see that in this 80%, you have a lot of people that are making tremendously important contributions. A school teacher, for instance. Now, I come from a country where a school teacher makes a lot of money. And there's a reason for that. Economically, this is capitalism too, Germany. But there are reasons for paying your school teachers a lot of money, or paying a well-qualified worker a lot of money. There are reasons for that. And that's not, cannot be naturalized with the 80-20%.
Okay, the other there.
The poll that you took with your students about which of the standing the United States or capitalism, how would those students define capitalism?
Oh, basically the way, well, this is a great question. I mean, what I talked about, not the end of the United States, I talked the end of the world, you know, this Christian idea that the world's going up in flame versus capitalism. And what they understand by capitalism is just the way things are now with the economy. I mean, they wouldn't distinguish between late capitalism, neoliberal capitalism, whatever. You know, I sometimes take students on immersion trips around the world. I take them to Germany. They don't even recognize the German system as capitalism, which it is. I mean, it's not socialism. Although there is free healthcare, free dental care, free education, free university education, mind you. And all that stuff that we think is not possible in capitalism seems to be possible. So what I'm saying then is simply, you know, they're assuming the world as it is right here, right now, in Dallas, Texas, probably, is what they assume as that's the way it's always going to be. And this is what worries me, because whenever you think of any system at all, you know, it might be a great system, might be a bad system, that's the way it's always going to be. Theologically, now I'm a theologian too, you've basically equated that system in God.
All right, so Wayne has the last question.
There was one more over there, could we?
Maybe.
But how about we collect both questions?
Okay.
I'll be sorry.
I heard you speak about the empirical element of religion. And I'm reminded of Habermas in Communicative Action. One, I think it's the first chapter. He sets out a grid work of social sciences. In particular, he's talking about psychology, sociology, political action, and political theory, and economics. And he says they are all dealing with the same subject matter. They have different perspectives and different methodologies, but it's all the same stuff they're dealing with. And it strikes me that what you are saying is that theology or religion is also dealing with that same subject matter. And I would be interested to hear your comment.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, I don't have a lot to comment on that. If what I'm saying is used as seen as a plea, I'm pleading to say don't separate out religion, but see it as part of everyday life. And that's the way religion has been dealt with and addressed for very many centuries. Only now in modern times, with the distinctions of these disciplines, have we drawn some artificial limits that are problematic, not just in the way you think, but that are really problematic also then in the way religious communities function. Because then the church becomes just a little playground somewhere, you know, where people go on Sunday and do their little religious thing, and then they come back to their real life on Monday. That's, you know, the bigger cultural problem behind it. But thanks for that comment.
Okay, Carl has the last question.
The history of religion, I think, is 1900 years, 1800 years. We didn't have much. We didn't live long. Life was dark and ugly. Since the Renaissance, since Enlightenment, reason, I think religion has been put in its place. We have rising wealth. We have increasing life. I do think, now to the question, I do think in the United States, in capitalism, first, it would be good to define that. And I would like to put forth capitalism, the proper definition. You almost have to say laissez-faire capitalism this day, meaning no government intervention.
Sure.
Today, we certainly have all kind of government intervention. We are in a mixed economy, so I think it's unfair, improper, from a definition, call it capitalism. You should say it's a mixed economy. The Fed runs the money, fiat money, they print what they want. We have a progressive income tax for the last 100 years, etc. But it does seem that religion has an impact today, you could argue, on economics. When George Bush stood up and said he was a compassionate conservative and said seniors need cheaper drugs, he passed Part D, the largest expansion of government. So that's a religious, that there's people that need. So we need to delve into economics, and we need to give. And then when President Obama says, you are your brother's keeper, there's 30 million people out there that need health care, we need the government to get into economics and redistribute that wealth. So your topic tonight, I think, certainly religion does absolutely impact our economics.
Thanks. I mean, in a way it does. Now, hopefully, you know, in neither of these cases, the presidents were simply arguing as Christians, because you could say that's also part of human values. You know, we just don't let people drop by the wayside. I mean, and I think there's part of human community, I mean, there's part of animal community that functions like that, that you don't just let people die, you know, if there's something you can do about that. Now, on the other hand, you know, what I'm saying is the debate here needs to go a lot further than this. This is not just about, you know, how do we help the poor. This is really a question about how do we value the various contributions that people make in labor, in work, in society. And that too, I think, is a religious question, because very oftentimes, you know, you think about higher earning jobs or higher paying jobs as you know, perhaps closer to God. But in the Jewish Christian imagery, you know, the second story of creation in the book of Genesis, God's actually a worker, putting Adam, the human being, together from clay, you know, doing stuff with God's hands rather than, you know, creating by fiat from the top down. So that's one example. And so that debate could be expanded a lot. But there's something else, and I think this is something, maybe this is a good place on which to close. As you can see, by the way, I don't have a Texas accent, but I greatly appreciate being here. I am an American citizen. I appreciate the American traditions, the American heritage. Something we all appreciate having to do, perhaps, I know, with a critical stance on religion and also on government in this country is that we question unilateral power, that we question a certain form of control, you know, big government and so on. But then again, I think that is precisely the question that could also be addressed in terms of big economics, right? I mean, if you are worried about big government, wouldn't you also have to be worried about a system where corporations are running the world? This is the other part why it's not a free market, because a lot of these large corporations, it's not like they're getting government welfare because the government wants to help them. They have the power to actually leverage the government, you know, and so it's not to say it's just the politicians that do this. It's kind of a mutual thing. Now, theologically, all I'm saying is if we raise these things as question marks, as a matter of discussion that then people of faith would discuss, but philosophers would discuss. So, I mean, why am I talking at a philosopher's forum? I really appreciate the fact that there are people who appreciate the power of thought, who appreciate the power of critical thinking, raising questions. And so all I'm saying really is kind of if we extend that moment of critical thinking in all kinds of directions, that would be very powerful, and I think it would really put us as a nation in a whole new game, because right now, the partisan game, you know, say Republican versus Democrat, everybody would agree, I guess, it's dysfunctional to some degree. But we're so confined to these boxes that it's very hard for a new thing to emerge here. So as a theologian, I'm arguing, let's get out of these boxes, and the way to do it then is really through practical engagement with what we really believe. So, thank you.